You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is now on Venmo. Follow us and send a donation anytime at KBOO Radio. That's at KBOO Radio. Thanks.
Welcome to the Talking Earth for mid-July here on KBOO Portland. What a month so far. Heat dome, wildfires, political collapse, virus explosions. No explosions here at KBOO. We are community-supported radio for over 50 years and need your continued support. The electric bills keep coming. We need computer upgrades, all that, and maybe raises for our staff people who work so hard. Please go to kboo.fm to see how you can contribute financially. And we always need volunteers to keep things going in all sorts of ways. You don't even have to be talking on the radio. I'm Dan Raphael and have three writers who cover all the seasons with their strong words, Tammy Lynn Stoner, David Perez, and Jennifer Bernock. I'll be throwing in a couple poems from Diane Seuss and Ben Lerner. But let's get started with Tammy Lynn Stoner. Tammy's an award-winning screenwriter and author of the novel Sugarland, which won an IPPY, was a finalist for the Crooks Corner Prize and a Four Words Book Award and a number one Amazon category bestseller. That's Kirkus review called A Ravishing Debut. She'll be reading poems tonight, but a VCAA fellow and Southwest Artist in Residence, Tammy's been published over a dozen times. Her TV pilot, Dipsomaniac, won Best Pilot in the 2023 Portland Screenplay Awards. Here's Tammy Lynn Stoner.
Hi, my name's Tammy Lynn Stoner, and I'm so excited to be here on KBOO. What I'm going to read are a couple of flash pieces and a couple of poems. Thanks again for having me. Okay, this first one is a poem called What My Dog Doesn't Know. My dog doesn't know there is an ocean, this thing that creates the patterns that warm her, this thing filled with creatures she doesn't know exist, this thing that connects her to the moon. My dog doesn't know there is gravity, needy in the way a mother calls every Sunday, ignoring your raspy voice, disappointed when you say you have work to do. My dog doesn't know that some of her kind don't fare well, that there are troubles we cause, we who bend her nature and pat her head, we who have bred friends from stolen children. What would she do if she knew? What do I not know? This is called We, a Network of Roots. We watch her raise her wrist, comparing the silhouette of my, our branches to the blue veins running afoul under paper skin. She likens us, me, us, to her feeling of surrender, the way we bend and yield, a leaf dropping, the giving of our skin. She is young. She wonders what we feel, and we wonder what the fish feels with its mouth gouged by steel. We wonder, but we don't feel, because feeling is a cloak, and we trees live only for truth. The world goes by. We sway, watching and commenting, root to root, from one neighbor to the next. Oh, the intrigue of the bird. Oh, the gentrification of wires. Oh, the sunset we once saw. And we wait, someday, for her veins to dry up and turn to dust and feed us. This is a little flash ditty called What Turns to Stone. I look up at the approaching pageantry walking across this newfangled grass that never needs watering. It's Mr. Naley with his smaller brothers walking behind him like baby turds dropping out of his ass, hopping across the lawn. One, two, three. Three turds, baby shit brown, on the greener than green turf. My knees are freezing up like a rock creature. The left one jitters every time Mr. Naley blows his whistle for the turds to line up, and they do, boy, they snap to, one right after the other in order of size. One holds clippers, one holds a bag for cuttings, and the smallest one carries a can of insect spray to reduce invading anthills to tobacco spit. My teeth are growing sweaters. I rub my tongue along them until the whistle brings my attention back to the pageantry. I'm right here, but as usual, they don't notice me. I've been sitting here for decades, but no one ever notices me. My skin is glazing up like a donut. I think about the heat and the sun and the reflections on the metal trash can lids at the curb, and I wonder if I can melt. Apparently not, since I am here watching the forward approach of the turds led by the ever-gallant Mr. Naley in his straw hat. The whistle speeds up, toot, 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 and I see the flashes of turds zip by me. When they reach me, one shimmies into the overgrown yard and the other two start to trim the huge, heavy leaves of my fig tree. I remind myself that that is not my fig tree. I remind myself that that is not my house. It used to be my fig tree and it used to be my house. I don't want another tree and I don't want another house. Those were my dying words. I don't want another house. This is where I loved her. This is the only place I loved her. She always woke up with a smile, one of those smiles that came to perfect points at the corners of her mouth, the kind of smile that made people take pictures. Her hair was nearly white. She had an English chin. She called it my English chin, that stuck out almost equal to her nose when you saw her in profile. And that smile, with her teeth shining in the sun. Even when she was upset with me, if you looked close enough, you could still see traces of that smile. That smile was just who she was, beautiful and fragile. My skull is caving in from the intensity. I feel the sting of gray cracks growing across the bone. They hurt as they edge their way towards the center of my head. Then I remember, I'm not human. The turds are, but I'm not. I'm just something that will sit here and love her forever. The next is a poem called They All Worried About Her. Moss grew in the folds of your skin, and I wonder if this is where your dreams run, in the low green hills, children in gray dresses with filthy hems always smelling like fire. They ask me to keep watch to see where you go, every bus, every tram, every car, big and slow and dark like sharks. I watch as you become a shadow and move around a corner, behind the trash cans and in through the crack window of the basement where you live. How can I tell them this? How can I tell them that it smelled like musty rabbit and wet earth in there, and that I saw you become chalk in the moonlight, your eyes shut, your lips blue? How can I tell them how your voice sang out then, fluttering and soft and strong, before it turned into butterflies? How can I tell them how beautiful you looked as you flew away? This is the last one, another short piece called A Confession. 30 years ago, I knew a girl who wore socks for days and days, a girl who only shaved her ankles because she never wore shorts, a girl who foretold the death of 35mm film before she died of a heroin overdose. Her name was Margot. Margot lived with me before she moved to New York with her boyfriend, who is my ex-boyfriend, Patrick, and I moved to Austin. We lived in West Philadelphia on Spruce Street, the 6th Brown Row House off 46th. A few times a week, we'd buy chicken strips by the strip at the African food joint next door, and afterward, we'd pinball home arm in arm and sit on my bed making tapes while the cats complained about their litter box. She had a brother who drank milk when we went out, and a mother who yelled too often and too loudly. She had an overbite and wore tinted glasses that never stayed high enough up on her nose. Her room smelled like patchouli and photo processing chemicals. She kissed too roughly, but without apology. Once she gave me a book about all our Scotch whiskey with a note printed inside. Don't forget our whiskey Sundays, but most of all, don't forget me. I love you. Had she not died, she would have been the first person to join Carlton's group. Carlton was a lanky guy I'd met on the bus one day. Carlton's group was called Lovers Anonymous. Carlton named it. Carlton wasn't very creative. Lovers Anonymous followed all the other Anonymouses. People wanting to recover from their obsession met daily if need be, chatted, confessed, supported, apologized, handed out chips, bought plants, got dogs, and ultimately started out again. Carlton is not gay, although that might be your first assumption, since men who start support groups tend to be either therapists, pedophiles, or homosexuals. If my mother ever reads this story, which she won't, she would smirk because therapists, pedophiles, and homosexuals form the three sides of her triangle of evil, which is not to be confused with her circle of debauchery, her square of idolatry, or her rectangle of disgusting television shows to boycott. In his youth, Carlton often felt compelled to prove that he was not gay. On a particularly macho night, the newly legal drinker straight-manned his way through a dozen vials of tequila, then managed to make a short, tightly wound woman sitting next to him smile. Her name was Tara. She usually only smiled at the expense of others, but she thought he was cute, despite his Spock-like ears. The next day, Carlton told his friend that Tara had, quote, hitched herself to the Carlton train. It would take 5 years in the forming of a poorly named support group before Carlton could admit that Tara didn't so much as hitch herself to the Carlton train as she got her shoelace stuck in the door as it was leaving the station. When Tara left him, she left no forwarding address. Carlton then fell into his vegetable drawer, and he stayed there for 4 months, snuggled up with 2 6-packs of Bud Light, a log of salami, and 3 rubbery carrots. Then he founded Lovers Anonymous. Carlton once read a life-changing tidbit about the samurai. Setting aside the beheadings and the swordplay, they were actually a peaceful, nature-loving group. The idea that they killed for a living resulted in twinges of spiritual woe, which resulted in spiritual reflection, which resulted in the interesting tidbit. The samurai believed the dead samurai reincarnate as samurai. They understood that the incongruity of their lives, and they knew that if they didn't change their ways, they would not evolve. They would be doomed to repeat their lives as samurai again. Had Margot lived, she might have boned Carlton. Let me rephrase that. She would have boned him, but she actually might have liked him, if for no other reason than his attachment to this tidbit. Margot wouldn't have lasted with Carlton despite his samurai tidbit. She only lasted with Irish drunks and or drug addicts. Sometimes I thought that if she could find the right person, then she could get her shit together, but the truth of the matter is that if she had found the right person, she would have pulled them apart too. Compounding matters, because she died, Carlton then got stuck with Tara. Although Margot would have pulled Carlton apart, they would have been kind tears, easy to mend. Tara, on the other hand, made sure all the lines were jagged and the pieces were scattered from here to there. Then Carlton got fucked up, chasing around the pieces of himself that kept flying away like flower petals. If it weren't for the other members of Lovers Anonymous, Carlton might have found himself strung out or knee-deep in a pool of quicksand made from thousands of tiny, gooey self-help books. Now my confession. Carlton isn't real. I made him up. But regardless, he suffered. I know he suffered. He suffered because you died, Margot. You may not know this, Margot, but your death fucks up people that aren't even real. Thank you.
And thanks to you, Tammy. I'm not going to read a couple poems from Diane Seuss's new book, Modern Poetry. Her previous book, Frank Sonnets, is quite amazing. You know, one of the greatest poetry books I've read, I believe. I need to read it again, for sure. But this new book is just called Modern Poetry. Little Fugue State. Far have I wandered, not knowing the names of where Long have I woven this dress of human hair. Here I've pitched my tent, here and there, not knowing my name or where, not even the color of my hair, nor why it tangles so, nor where my comb goes, nor where my brush, how far I wander through the underbrush into onrush, not where my body was, not what it called itself, not the nature of my calling, not what my scrawling meant, not that scrawl then, not this scrawl here, nor what a self could be, nor what a bee could be, nor breath, nor poetry, this dog I've walked and walked to death. Monody. Kindness, like enthralling madness after shock treatments, is first to go. In the past, I snapped the bean spines, aware that something died so I could thrive. But this emptiness makes even a nightingale consumable. As for the song and red tail feathers, take them, here. I just don't care. To grieve is a dilettantish stand-in for the subject of my grief. What I'm saying is the verb is a canned performance of the missing noun. Or I'm saying I don't know how to feel anymore. Use metaphor, but don't adhere to her, as more than once I was used, but not admired. Gertrude Stein. I just brushed the dog there on the dog's couch. I was wearing a black, well, to call it a gown is a criminal overstatement, a black rag. It became clear to me, and when I say clear, I mean the moment was crystal cathedral. I could see my life from not a long shot, but what they used to call an increment apart, a baby step to the right or left of myself, about the width of a corrective baby shoe. There I was, broad-shouldered, witch-shaped without the associated magic, with my dog in my shack. Once mauve faded to pink, beyond sex or reason, a numbness had set in. Gertrude Stein, Picasso's portrait of her, that above it all, or within it all, look on, not a face, but the plates that suggest the face. The eyes aren't really lined upright, or the real eyes are peering from behind the curious shapes of eyes. The couch had been sort of, not a gift, but a donation of sorts from a person with plenty of money. When it was dragged into my house, it was already stately, but with worn patches and stains. A trinity of dogs over time had laid claim to it, three egotists. To brush the dog meant I had to visit it in its monarchy, and in that visit, that single prismatic increment, I saw I'd become, maybe all arrive in their own time, some before dying, some after, a draped artifact, haystack or headstone rising out of the plains, and then, with fascination and a degree of sadness and even objectivity, I loved, as I once loved tender buttons, myself. Diane Seuss, from Modern Poetry. My next featured reader, writer, is David Perez. David served as the 2014-2016 Santa Clara County Poet Laureate. He's recipient of the Arts Council Silicon Valley Fellowship for Literary Art and the National Association for Latino Arts and Culture Achievement Award. He is the author of the poetry collection Love in a Time of Robot Apocalypse, how timely, from Right Bloody Publishing. Most recently, his work has appeared in Caesura, The Wild World, Word, and the DMQ Review. He has taught literature and creative writing at San Jose State University and Ohlone, hope I'm saying that right, College in Fremont, California. And here's David.
Thanks, Dan, for having me on the show. My name is David Perez, and I'm excited to share some of my poems with you and your listeners today. If there's a common thread within these pieces, I would say that they're all rooted in the stuff of daily life. They are all trying to peel back the surface layer of the mundane or the commonplace in order to sneak up on a growing sense that I have that there is actually no such thing as stability or permanence or a settled order of nature. And that is probably more than enough introduction. So I'll go ahead and just dive into the first piece. This poem's called Familiar Dimensions. The campus cafeteria smells like maple syrup and sweaty cheese. I wait for my coffee, wearing a blue polka dot button-up, which makes me feel pretty ridiculous. My only other clean shirt was solid black. Too somber for today's lecture. Yesterday came the news. Another school shooting in a town whose name I've forgotten. Days like this, I give a speech to ease the tension where every idea sounds somehow too alarming and not alarming enough. Heading to my classroom, I notice which hallways create bottlenecks, and I plan the fastest route to the nearest exit and imagine running in zigzags to reach it. I nod to another professor, a nod that belongs in a film about a naval battle, two officers touring a vessel on high alert. But instead of nodding back, she smiles, waves hello. Of course she does, because today is the day that it all becomes normal. The day our American problem slips into a sleeve, both out of sight and always in reach, a holster broken in against familiar dimensions. The students enter in bright sneakers and loose sweatsuits, heads bowed before handheld screens that they will soon put away without me even asking. A good group this term. And as they count their likes and they chat about binge-worthy TV shows, it's obvious. There is no tension. Nothing in the air to clear. And I am thinking about what this means when Daniela says to me, "Nice shirt." And Rakesh adds, "Yeah, Mr. Perez, I thought you were allergic to fashion." It's all in good fun. The kind of levity that keeps us human. So I try very hard to smile. Okay, that was Familiar Dimensions. This next poem is very different, but like I said before, kind of on the theme of impermanence, this general idea that stability is actually a complete myth. So this next poem is called When the Doorbell Finally Rings. If you know that everything ends, and have accepted this quietly as one of adulthood's deeply unsexy truths, then why does the end keep on showing up in the middle of things? It wakes you up early to watch you lie there, mustering the guts to face another day. It's there at breakfast, reminding you that you are biting into the last piece of bacon. Every morning, the end chooses a mask from the coat rack and you leave together, shoulder to shoulder, the floorboards creaking under your combined weight. Some days, the end is dressed to kill, looking like a new bat flu or a rare malignant tumor, but most days, it's just a douchebag weaving through traffic in a BMW. Even on the days when your daughter hugs you and you ask, "What's this for?" And she answers, "Just because." The end is there, tightening your grip as you feel her letting go. When the doorbell finally rings, and the end is there with a clipboard handing you a brochure about soft shores waiting behind a luminous veil, will you be ready? Will you be glad for the pilings you sank into your chest to carry this moment's impossible weight? Or will you have just made a pincushion from a perfectly good heart? You don't have to answer that. It's all right if you leave something on the table. Yes, unfinished morsels will harden to your dinner plate. But someone will think of you as they scrape it clean. All right. Speaking of daily life and the ways in which it finds its way into my poems, this next poem is about a real life experience, a true story, a childhood memory that I kind of, I guess, conjured up during a writing exercise. And this poem is called Prank Call. They were just kids, able to make themselves sound like cops on the phone, telling my mom that a man with a knife was outside our house. I remember her screaming three times before setting off the burglar alarm, and then finding my sister and I frozen at the TV. How she held us tight, her breath high and close amid the alarm's metallic chirps and the xylophones of Saturday morning cartoons. There was no man, no knife, but how easy it was to believe the end was near. How quickly the mind painted its killer's face, issued him a rusty blade, new blue jeans, steady eyes, and short boyish hair, all facts that I crafted and then placed on the windowsill to prepare for daylight to dim as our guest arrived in the space between us and the sun. This next piece is called Crisis Hotline Recovery. We were in the pub, playing the game where you point out a guy with a horrible tattoo and imagine his favorite pickup line. To the gentleman at the bar with the phoenix rising from the flames at the base of his neck, we gave the line, "Girl, you must be a campfire because you're super hot and I want some more." I breathed in the smoke that seconds ago clung to the insides of a stranger's lungs as the voice on the phone last night replayed in my ear, asking politely if I had pills or a gun, or a note already waiting somewhere to be discovered. We switched to the game where you slide a coaster so it teeters over the table's edge, flick it upward, and then catch it midair. The guy with the phoenix was now whispering something in the bartender's ear, unable to see how it made her smile, and how that smile was now framed in the window, a bright spot against the darkness outside. And the night seemed to be getting deeper, like it was rolling a boulder from the mouth of some passageway. And it's not that I wanted to leave, and it's not that I wanted to stay. It just would have been all right if I had never been there. This next poem is rooted in a really specific place for me. It's rooted in a unhoused encampment that is just around the corner from where I live that was recently cleared. And I discovered shortly before it was cleared that an old friend of mine actually was living there. And fortunately, I was able to reconnect with him and help him out a little bit. And this poem isn't so much about our relationship directly, but it is about that place and just an experience that brought it to the front of my mind. And this poem is called "There Is No Honest Peace." The gas station in my neighborhood plays opera at uncomfortable volumes. Mezzo-sopranos and blaring oboes hijack the airspace normally reserved for mini-mart advertisements. These cloying jingles about candy and corn dogs replaced with big fat piano chords. From the pumps, I used to steal glances at the owner inside behind the checkout counter, wanting to offer him a gesture of approval. A slow nod to a fellow loud music aficionado for blasting Rigoletto at vision-blurring amplitudes worthy of Black Sabbath and Megadeth. And then it hit me. The owner probably doesn't like opera at all, and only plays it to keep the local unhoused population off his doorstep. Like how the U.S. Army weaponized Bon Jovi and the Doors in Panama to make Noriega vacate the premises. One night, I heard Vivaldi's Nulla in Mundo Passincera from a block away, and as that soprano rang into the black air, a man went past me, walking a bike with both tires flat. Our eyes met. And we nodded in deference to that voice, thin in baseless speakers, like an angel trapped in a tin can. This next poem is dedicated to my mom, who recently survived a bout with cancer. She's doing a lot better now, but it was quite a scare, and this piece came out of it. It's called Someone Has to Tell the Bees. When the queen dies, someone has to tell the bees. The keeper ties black cloth to the gate of their habitat and whispers the news into the quivering mass humming in the dark. Same goes for the corgis and the royal ravens. When my mother's eyes close, and her hand stops squeezing mine, there won't be any animals around. I've heard that dogs can sense it, and that for a few days the cat might spend more time on your lap, but all Mom has are plants. Will they seem brighter? Seem to reach a little higher? If I were king, I'd have someone tell the plants. I'd have them play OK Computer in the Alnwick Poison Garden and speak into the blooming faces of the nightshade, thanking it for all the pupils it's dilated, all those beautified Venetian eyes. I'd have them whisper into the open bells of the angel's trumpet and the laurel whose cyanide used to kill trophy butterflies. I'd have them dig up the devil-limbed mandrake, hush his screams as they drag him into the light, and then touch a blade to both of his knobby shoulders and assure him that his service has truly been exemplary. All right, my time with you is coming to a close. I got just one last poem. If many of those poems that I've read today are about death or about endings, this one is very much about life. It's called Taut in the Same Wind, and that's taut, like when you pull a rope tight, taut in the same wind. Never hate the maze more than you love the rats trapped inside it. Never stand tall when you can kneel to pet the black cat. Try to laugh. Try to laugh at the world the madmen made. Try to be gentle with yourself when the boss's red face shouts at you as sweat runs down your spine. Remember that everyone, the people standing on the train, the doctor in your delivery room, the face in the mirror, and the woman who sang your name, everyone is a different sail taut in the same wind. Remember, there is a tunnel at the end of the light. Its walls are green with ivy, and the air smells like iron and rain. There are footprints in the soft dirt leading to its mouth, and no soul leaves the world without brushing another on its way inside. in that place, someone found your story, floating on the surface tension of a sulfur spring, and they saw so much wrapped inside it that they begged the thing that makes the snail slide. They begged the thing that makes the honeycomb weep. They begged the thing that makes the vines crawl up the trellis for you to come to life.
Yeah, thanks, David Perez. A reminder that you're listening to The Talking Earth on KBOO, community-sponsored, free-ranged, across all the spectrums of radio and electromagnetism. And since we're commercial-free and there's no money in poetry, KBOO needs your donations to pay the bills and our handful of overworked staff. Go to our website, kbo.fm, and see how easy it is to give us some of your money. Let's get another poem from, not another, the first poem will be here, from Ben Lerner's The Lights. Maybe we'll do two. Let's see what time we got. The Stone. "Imagine a song," she said, "that gives voice to people's anger." These weren't her actual words. "The anger precedes the song," she continued, "but the song precedes the people. The people are backformed from their singing, which socializes feeling, expands the domain of the feelable. The voice must be sung into existence, so song precedes speech, clears the ground for it." "Then how are we speaking now?" I asked, although not on those words. "We aren't," she responded. "Or we are, but only about whether one should take her cat to the vet in a pandemic, if I should form a pod with my neighbors, if mangoes are a stone fruit. A people's voice isn't speaking through us." I pulled a handful of grass from the earth, which left the earth with almost no resistance. "We're just talking," she continued, "which isn't really speaking. Talk precedes the song that makes speech possible. But we can talk about singing. We can describe the song and its conditions, sitting in our blankets in Fort Greene Park, the taped-off police cruiser still smoldering nearby, dragonflies mating aloft in the humid air above us. Can the song be talked into existence?" I asked. I wanted to ask, just as I wanted the grass to resist more, to cling more passionately to the earth. The stems are hollow, except at the nodes. They have evolved to withstand trampling and storms. "I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love," the poet wrote, "which is neither speech nor singing, but a grassy area between them cordoned off by cops." Strange how poet and cop are anagrams. Agitated starlings had gathered in the trees. "Let's think up some new collective noun," she didn't. She didn't say an agitation of starlings, a bevy, a herd, a game, a flight, a pod, a murder of people with stone voices pinned to the ground of experience, the ethical ground. In that sense, throwing stones is close to singing when you shatter glass, which is made by heating grass into a liquid, and the goal of song is to liquefy things. The singer most of all. When she sings, she can't pull the song back out, and when she flees, she leaves behind parts of her digestive tract, muscles, nerves. You can hear that sorrowful foreknowledge in the song. Smoke masks pheromones, so the keeper can access the hive. Strange that song and smoke are homophones. But even a dead singer can sing. Even a singer a scrub jay has decapitated will sing if you step on it. Ben Lerner from The Lights. Rounding out tonight's trio of features is Jennifer Bernock, or JB. She is a writer currently living in Portland. Her work can be found in Shark Reef, Minerva Rising, Pinkfish Press, and University of Nebraska Gender Programs. Her work has been performed at Actors Theater of Orcas Island, Orcas Center, and Mother Foucault's Airborne Poetry Festival. She is the founder of Dropout, a tech-free writer's residency in Parkdale, Oregon. And here's Jennifer, or JB.
This is the first chapter of a memoir in progress, and it's just so pleasing to be able to put it out there on Talking Earth. The title is What I Tell My Friends About You. I tell people this book is about all my exes, but it's really about why we stay in bad love. And I want to disrupt the easy answer to the question, why doesn't she just leave? And the book shifts back and forth in time. And as it progresses, I directly address a different ex-boyfriend in all the chapters. And eventually, all the men blend into one. And I'm really doing that on purpose to show that staying or leaving a toxic relationship isn't really about the other person. It's about ourselves. So in this section, I'm talking to an ex-boyfriend, Ian. What I tell my friends about you. California, 1978. This is how I learned to desire rescue, to occasionally seek it, to value false saviors, then love them without reason, jumping off ledges after them, my skirt billowing over my head in the fall. I am 5 years old and I wake up flat on my back on the front lawn of my childhood home, a suburban neighborhood ranch in Northern California. It's the deep 1970s. I am a heavy sponge, saturated, and I can hold no more. The first thing I notice is that my braid is undone. My hair feels like a wet wool blanket, heavy, pulling on me. My very long red hair is my one recognizable trait. Every morning, my mother roughly brushes the knots out of it with one of her hands capped to the top of my head and pushes on my skull with all her milky strength to keep me in place. My whole body leans into each stroke. I bob free when released like I've been in a wave until she takes hold again. It hurts when her comb hits a knot, tears bubble and slide down, but I suppress all other signs of pain from her. When satisfied, she swiftly handworks it into a braid, affixes a rubber band at the end with three fast twists and lets it go, gently knocking on my back. She gives me the hand mirror so I can see myself for a second. I look just like Laura Ingalls in Little House on the Prairie, my favorite character, the freckled smart one who stands up for herself, the one who understands her father better than anyone simply because she follows him around. Laura's nickname is Half Pint. My dad calls me Jen Bird. I feel so totally known inside this television show set in the Pioneer West, like I am Laura. Watching from the green shag floor in the living room with the rest of my family up on the chairs and couches, sometimes I wonder if they see it. I sneak peeks up at them while Laura does something wonderful, like punch the bully Nellie right in the nose or helps Pa defend the cabin from outlaws. From the carpet, I look up at my favorite sister, Laura. Yes, her name is Laura. Does she see it too? This whole show is about me. When she is done braiding me, Mom pats me on the shoulder, says, okay. She means get up and go away now. This is the only mother-daughter contact we will have all day. On the grass, I know I've been somewhere else. I've been taken back home, like time travel. All at once, I can see again, blurry at first, but shapes and colors come back with the precision that had been lost. I can smell. I can smell like a superpower. The acrid green walnut husks that have fallen from my favorite tree, my sister's baby oil for tanning, my mother's sticky, cloying apricots as they bake on racks in the sun in the backyard, the atmospheric sulfur of a California summer. It is as if someone has waved a wand and returned me to the place of color and odor and feeling. But my hearing has not returned. There is a commotion, but I have no ears. Am I still in the water? I open my eyes and see our house number 18831 in black metal affixed to the lime green garage. The number I memorized just a week ago is attached to the decorative silhouette of a wrought iron cowboy cooking over a fire. His profile comes in and out of my line of sight because there is a huge man kneeling over me. His head is like a bowling ball, heavy and without features. I feel the pressure of his knee on my feet. He is handling me like no one has ever touched me, and I am a thing to be shaken, a lawnmower to pull start. His mouth is covering my own and my nose. His mouth is wet. There are drips of water wicking off his mustache, and they fall on my face each time he comes forward to cover my mouth again. It is like reverse crying. There is a rhythm to what he's doing. It's like Miss Judy counting steps in ballet class, 5, 6, 7, 8. His mustache is just like my daddy's, but this man smells like a car, not my father's Irish Spring. I think this man wants me to do something, but I don't know what it is, and he's being awfully rough about it. At 5, I don't understand that the cowboy on the garage is a symbol of bravery. I figure out later it is something about how my parents left Chicago to move west with their 4 kids. I can picture them as they drove away in a station wagon with all the windows open, my mother wiping tears and my dad waving like a guest on a talk show to all the people they had ever known. All those people never left to go west or anywhere. That's how I imagine it now. One day my dad decided to be something else, picked up his wife and kids, bought a cowboy hat on the way, palmed it down on his head with the confidence of Charles Ingalls, and felt deliciously alive, maybe for the first time in his life. Feeling like his family was complete. He was the leader of a troop on an expedition to see new lands and live by an ocean, to find out what the rest of the world in the 1970s might offer him in gold. 3 years later, I was a surprise pregnancy. On the garage, there is a curly cue of smoke coming from the cowboy's pan, ending at a point like a blade. The lawn is a bed of dull needles grown summer sharp. I know the green of it, too dark for grass. It's not a lawn for bare feet. Without warning, all the water inside me shoots out of my mouth into the face of the man with the mustache. I am ashamed and I don't know why. Sounds exist again, a siren droning in place, an audience of neighbors' voices, a police radio, my 11-year-old sister telling everyone her cat is lost. I don't know where my mother is. My first memory is of being saved, of being pulled back, forced into life, and waking up in this world again on a lawn as a paramedic gives me CPR. Later, someone tells me I nearly drowned in the next door neighbor's pool, that my teenage sister was the first to notice me, a shape in a purple bathing suit on the floor of the deep end, my face on the drain. She jumped in and hauled my body out. Orcas Island, 2012. When I tell you, Ian, the story of almost drowning, I tell you about the light. I tell you that when we die, there is weightlessness, and yes, a gentle pulling toward a light at the end of a tunnel. The tunnel has no walls. It's like a cheesecloth of existence. There is complete freedom from pain there. No temperature, no texture, no physical body and its borders, no odor, no taste, no sound. That it is just like floating so very slowly into a bright glowing place without fear or trying. It just happens. It's easy. I know it sounds like bullshit, Hefe, I tell you. We are sitting outside near the garden where I'm picking random weeds wearing only a black slip, holding a cup of coffee in my other hand. You, with your wilderness rescue skills, your coated gun safe, your tow ropes under the driver's seat, and even your CNA obtained at a non-name community college via a cheap accelerated program. You, the one I put myself into danger with again and again, because I love you. For your first response, your engineer's mind, your reliability, your willingness to jump in and help when called. I don't see the contradiction. I don't say the blatant fact of it. When I was 5, I exited life and was forced back, and everyone brought me teddy bears to the hospital. Sometimes you don't know you love someone until you almost lose them. As an adult, solidly middle-aged, a lover and a partner, I've conflated rescue and seduction, savior and sex. I stay wet for a man in uniform. With you, I play out the scene on repeat, I faint, you catch. It rarely occurs to me to save myself, and I forget the many times I've done just that. Asking you to leave was a day that I saved myself. telling you not to come back and meaning it. But it will be decades before I know myself this way, as my own rescuer. Know it solidly, confidently, without a doubt, just like I knew for sure I was Laura Ingalls. Self-rescue eludes me. I wonder if it will ever arrive. Brave, wild frontier, standing up in the face of outlaws with nothing but 3 rounds and a Springfield rifle. Would this new self-knowledge hold me, keep me safe? Could I be stronger than the weight of water? Portland, 2016. I know you love me because sometimes when you look at me, you cock your head to the side and smile with your chin pulled in. It's the facial equivalent of saying, aw. When I'm putting the groceries away, you hold the fridge door open so it doesn't keep banging on my side while I rearrange the milk and eggs. You always answer when I call you, begging, please, Ian, just tell me where you are. You leave me notes on the pillow written in your script of shy, narrow letters. Have a great day, Firefly. Your body is like the big guy on the swim team, tall and trim and wide. Michael Phelps at 40. The way your teeth fit in your mouth is Phelps-like too, front tooth prominent. You joke about your lack of buoyancy, but I know you did that tough guy open water survival training, certified by some military-like organization, treading water in the open ocean in a survival suit, carrying weights while doing it, and holding your breath for an ungodly amount of time. Scenes from a Tom Clancy novel. I know when you were a very young man, you worked in the Middle East for a time, doing something that paid very well. This job involved guns without serial numbers and motorcades and the words recovery mission. Now you call it a weird time in your life. You showed me a photo of yourself just before you left on a ship. Your hair was cut close like it still is today, nothing to move in any particular direction. But in the photo, it was all brown, not a mix of white and gray. In it, you were alone on a hill with the Golden Gate Bridge behind you. You say that was when you were still young and bright. We're spooning on the couch in your sparse apartment, watching an action movie. In the shot, a bunch of army tanks are ripping through a small village. Thick plumes of dust fly over women in light robes sitting at a roadside table. I comment, why do Americans always have to be such big dick assholes everywhere they go? Your voice is low and even when you say, convoys travel without following distance at high speed to protect the whole. Isn't that kind of the same thing? I chuckle. Affirmative, you say, smiling, and you pull the blanket up over us, tucking it under my chin. You don't ever say the word Halliburton, but I figure it's something like that. Once, I wonder out loud if you'd ever get a tattoo and ask what it would be if you did. You tell me flat, quick, no tattoos. Tattoos identify a body. Your attitude towards drugs is puritanical. You've never so much as puffed a joint. Me with my marijuana-entwined past, growing, consuming, delivering, sometimes does not make sense. Am I your wild side? My life feels so tame and serious, just a single mom working a million jobs to make it. How can I be anyone's wild side? Another day, we drive north 2 hours and go swimming in the unheated indoor pool of your childhood home. I step gingerly into the pool in a blue bikini, a little insecure about the soft jiggle of my thighs, a big purple vein on my leg, and my total lack of melanin. I raise my arms above my head to twist my hair into a top bun. With the rubber band between my teeth, I warn you not to roughhouse with me. I've had a bad experience, I remind you, giving a throwaway laugh and fixing the bun quickly. I know, you say. You're already in the water, in a motionless crouch to keep your 6+ feet submerged in 5 feet of water, waiting, watching me. The waterline is above your nose and you are blowing bubbles slowly, your light blue eyes fixed on my old lady descent into the cold water. At thigh height, the chill is too much, so I inelegantly plop into the water hole. You smile at my breathless cries of, "Oh my God, it's so cold," as I flail. You move to me slowly, a human squid, while I take in the shock of temperature. Your long, thick arm, it circles my waist and pulls me slowly into your lap. My ass finds your hip bones, my seat. We fit, as they always do, despite their disproportionate sizes. Our bodies have a fit that is like none other, a return of missing pieces, a coming home, a righting of all things that are wrong. I pull my legs up, curling into a ball, and rest my feet on your thighs. Your wet lips brush my ear. You whisper, "I know every single freckle." It affects me like a sedative. You wrap your other arm around me too. I'm encased. I feel your heart beating on my back and it travels down my spine. You move us backward, you floating on your back, me floating on you. Your legs are barely moving as you take us farther, leaving the shallow. I am drugged by my trust in you, this giving over of all control in your embrace. Right now, there is nothing else in the world but the two of us. No shore, no boat, not a single other soul. I believe you will always keep me safe, and I want that more than anything. Then I let you take me to the deep end, and I can no longer reach the bottom.
Thanks, Jennifer. And one more from the wonderful Diane Seuss, Against Poetry. A poem, unlike a living being, cannot perceive you, and in perceiving you, grant you reality. If it sleeps with you, it cuts you. It runs a few degrees cooler than room temperature. A love poem does not love you, or does not necessarily love you. A love poem faces outward. It performs love adequately, lately. I wondered about poetry's efficacy. It's like doubting a long romance, or romance itself, the essence of it. Fearsome, no doubt, to doubt your life's foundation. I've always wondered about painting. What distinguishes a good or great painting, paintings I've loved, from illustration? Lately, everything seems illustrative to me, as if the world is a cunning metaphor. A young painter once cautioned me not to bring a literary framework to visual art. A sane admonition, I think. Maybe what distinguishes art from illustration is its uselessness. Art, useless at its core, but not valueless. And what is the correlation between painting and poetry? What makes a poem merely illustrative, and what elevates it to an essential artfulness, i.e., uselessness? I know I'm using the old language here, merely elevates. I am in an antiquated room, its fixtures dust-covered and ornate, furniture having been built at the behest of another area from a principle of design that forefronts beauty is delicate, as if balanced on a foal's trembling legs. Maybe to live within a poem is to entrap oneself in an architecture constructed upon outmoded theories of composition. It's possible there is an undiscovered room or house or a structure somewhere I don't yet have the language for, an academy of silences, a cathedral of cross-purposed voices, a post-human spaciousness filled only with a re-emerged species of butterflies, a catacomb of clusterflies. Whatever it will be new, filled with its own mystifying absurdities and likely beyond me. This body may not be built for it. Mine is the kind of body you drag around town on a leash with a choke chain. You don't love it, but it's yours to contend with, though it compresses your soul. When did it begin to compress rather than liberate my soul? Early. But I do remember when it was my soul's instrument, or indistinguishable from my soul. I could sit on the fright stoop, and the whole world came streaming in through the structures of my senses. Maybe the body is the soul's metaphor. Maybe to escape it is to escape the service economy, to dissolve analogy, attain uselessness.
Diane Seuss, powerful words, lots to think about, as we've had all this hour with my three featured readers, Tammy Lynn Stoner, David Perez, and Jennifer Bernack. Got to get those accents in the right place. Thanks to
all of you for listening and for coming for the poetry. Thanks to Talking Earth founders Barbara Lamorticella and Walt Curtis, to the show's producer and other host, Patrick Bocard, to all the places around town sponsoring readings, the places selling books, especially small press, to the wonderful staff and volunteers that keep KBOO on the air, and to all of you who support KBOO. Remember, love poetry, love your neighbors. Let's talk about it. Remember, the most important thing we can do in the next coming months is to make sure that Donald Trump does not get back in the White House and we have a chance of maintaining American democracy. The poetry of democracy, the democracy of poetry. Good night.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO's listeners value community, authenticity.